Hi guys, welcome to episode 7 of the MHP podcast. Today we'll be discussing single leg training, the truth about knee valgus, and easy load management. To start off, we're going to get specific and we're going to talk about unilateral movements. Jacob, what are the benefits of unilateral compared to bilateral movements in training?
Yeah, there's quite a few, I would say. I'm a bit of a Mike Boyle disciple from my earlier years in the industry, and he's kind of like the OG single leg training proponent. And some of the biggest kind of sales points would be, first of all, the bilateral deficit essentially alludes to the fact that you can lift more weight on one leg than half of what you can lift on two legs, meaning that you train your left leg, you train your right leg, you've now lifted more in total than you could have if you did both together.
Yeah.
So you're actually giving a greater stimulus to the leg itself. On top of that, you have more kind of frontal plane lateral stability demands, where now your adductors and your abductors on the inside outside of the hip have to do a lot more work to keep the knee tracking in line. And then there's also the component of the spinal loading, because if you load up on a back squat, let's say your max is 300 pounds, in order to lift something near your max, you're going to have to put 300 pounds on your spine.
Yeah.
Whereas if you do, say, a split squat, even if you still load it on your back, say you're doing 175 pounds, if we use some bilateral deficit kind of estimation, then you're putting less load on the spine, which is going to be good for long-term health and lifting longevity and all the rest. And then you're getting the same, or if not, again, better stimulus to the leg itself.
And using this concept to one's advantage, how can an athlete kind of recognize asymmetries and then work to strengthen them? What's an ideal structure plan that you think would actually really work?
Some people say, like, you do single leg training to avoid compensations.
Yeah, as in, and like eliminate asymmetries.
Yeah, as in if I do a two-leg squat, I'm going to use one leg more than the other.
Yeah.
And therefore, if I split them up, that won't be the case. In my experience, people are very, very, very good compensators. And if they have a weak leg, they will find a way to compensate around it so that basically both legs end up working the same. And having some technical difficulties here, I think. So what happens is, if you have a weaker leg, the weaker side is going to find, you're going to use some other muscle, you're going to move in some other way to get around that. And that's a
It's subconscious though, isn't it? Like you don't tell your body, oh, I'm gonna use more of my glute max compared to whatever. Like, it's just how your, it's like your body's survival instinct.
Absolutely.
Of just, I need to get up in the squat and I'm just gonna push up with whatever I have.
That's exactly what happens. And almost never is the person aware that they're doing it.
Never, no.
So it becomes a little bit complicated in terms of either having someone that can observe what you're doing and be really picky about the movement pattern, or choosing an exercise that almost makes it impossible to compensate around. Like, I'm thinking as an example, take a reverse lunge where you're going to step back, drop into a lunge, and then push yourself forward. One of the sneaky ways to cheat around that is just to push more off the back leg as you step forward.
Yeah.
Rather than keeping your weight anchored on the front leg. So if you instead put yourself into something like a skater squat, which is basically a reverse lunge, but the back leg doesn't touch the ground, a lot more challenging. You're not going to be able to load it nearly as much. And to be honest, a lot of early strength trainees probably won't be able to do it at all. But if it's something you're able to do, it's one way where there's almost no way to compensate unless you're doing something really crazy and obvious with the upper body. But I think that would be one thing is have some eyes on you that can watch for those big compensations and then choose exercises that are maybe anchored more towards isolating a muscle. And that's the other thing too. If you feel one or maybe two muscles doing a lot of the work, and it's the muscles you know are supposed to be doing the work, you're probably just fine. Whereas if it's kind of like, oh, everything's kind of doing something and it's a little bit chaotic, it might not be a bad exercise and it might not be executed poorly. That's not a bad thing to feel. But in the essence of chasing asymmetries and things, you kind of want to have a kind of focused load. So it should be somewhat obvious.
And I know that you mentioned about, especially with unilateral movements, that you want to make sure that your knee is kind of tracking actually over your foot. And you mentioned a term called knee valgus. Let's go more into that. And Jacob, what is knee valgus? Explained in a very simple way.
Basically, it's just when the knee travels inside where the hip, if you draw a line from the hip to the foot, if the knee travels inside towards the middle of that line, and then typically the reason people are fearful of it or trying to avoid it is because it puts a lot of unwanted stress on the knee, and that position tends to be associated with a lot of injuries that we see at the knee. So it's something you are typically looking to avoid it in everything that you do.
And so why is it so controversial in training? I know you just mentioned that it could put some damage to the knee, but specifically, what structure does it put kind of in stress, and when are they actually okay to use?
Yeah, so it can be associated with things like ACL tears and things like that, but also,
So the ligaments of the knee.
MCL could be involved and things like that. But the thing that maybe is a little controversial is most people just see the knee traveling inward and say, that's valgus, that's bad, when a lot of athletes use a certain loading strategy that looks like valgus, but actually isn't. And the difference is the knee is only going to follow where the hip and the foot go for the most part. Valgus is basically when it doesn't follow the hip and the knee. But if,
So it's when the hip and the foot is facing forward, for example, and the knees are just caving in.
exactly. So if you have your hips rotating inward, if I use my arms as an example, if the hips rotate inward, I guess arms are going to be opposite. But if the hips rotate inward and then the knees are coming towards the middle, you might have a knee that's actually bending in its perfect alignment. It's just oriented towards the middle. And there's
But
no un
the other parts of the body are compensating for it, so it's not necessarily going out of it's like the wrong range of motion.
Right. So what happens is if the hip is rotated in and the foot is either rotated in or pronated, meaning kind of like the inside edge of the foot is turned downward, you're probably setting the knee up to track perfectly. And the knees are gonna go together. You see this a lot of times. There's a lot of NBA players that shoot when they take a jump shot, the knees almost touch. And it's not valgus. It's just internal rotation of the hip, which then orients the knees facing each other. And I promise you, there's no unwanted stress on the knee there. All they're doing is rotating the hip to stretch the glute, and it actually gives you more force output from the hips. So it's something that usually is never trained because if anything, coaches are trying to get your knees out. It's something athletes do subconsciously to get that little bit of extra force out of the hips. And I think the tricky thing is knowing what's moving and what's not, because if your knees are falling towards the middle in a lot of different exercises, it's not exactly the right answer to say, oh, well, that's just my hips rotating, because maybe your hips don't have good internal rotation. And then what you see with those knees going in is actually just this valgus that we're talking about. So it would be good to get an assessment of how your hip can move to actually see, can you get in those positions? Because a lot of people and athletes and people in general that I test, internal rotation tends to lack often.
Yeah.
So it's a
It's not
very
trained often.
exactly. So if you assume your internal rotation isn't very good, then working on it, improving it, means that you're probably going to put less stress on the knee, because probably your body's trying to create that force by turning inward a little bit. And if the knee tracks in without the hip rotating alongside it, that's where the recipe for disaster comes from.
And so I do believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, that knee valgus is almost more appropriate during an actual sport performance rather than in the gym. Because I feel like, for example, if you're doing like a split squat, and you're going down and in all your weights on the front knee, and your front knee caves in, technically that is valgus because your feet are still pointing forward and your hips pointing forward. What are some example of some exercises? I don't know if this is on the spot, but what are some example of exercises where knee valgus is acceptable when you're lifting unilaterally?
Well, I'll say not the valgus, but that kind of internal rotation where the knees rotate inwards. There was an exercise I kind of made up or discovered years and years back. I used it a lot at the time, where this is going to be hard to explain. I had a cable in my left hand, but it was my right foot, my right side closest to the cable machine. And I kind of dropped into at a wide stance. And I basically, if you imagine what it looks like when, maybe I'll put a video over this, when someone does like a really low crossover, where they're really like lunging really, really low into the one side and the other knee turns inward. So you got a lunge on one side and the other knee's basically almost like behind the front knee. Everything's rotated forward for it to snap back out. I was essentially doing that with like a lateral cable pull. So
For resistance.
I would reach with the cable, twist my body towards it, let my right hip turn in as my pelvis moves around it, and then my right knee come all the way under me, and then I would snap off of it, and I'd do this really explosive push where the force wasn't coming from my arm and my back muscle. It was coming off that front side hip. As it does that external rotation, that's where that force that we're talking about comes from. And then if you do it with a rhythm where you're kind of popping out, dropping in, and you're timing it with the flow of the weight and things like that, it was one of the best exercises I found for training the glute through like an explosive kind
Yeah,
of
through like a
push-off
full movement.
motion. And in that situation, you have the loaded hip, the front hip that's internally rotating under load. And then the other hip that's not necessarily loaded because all my weight's on the right side, but it's also rotating in to be the thing that kind of pops out and then leads you out of it. If you watch someone do like a really aggressive crossover, it's basically mimicking that movement.
And they get really, really low too. And relating this a little bit also to landing mechanics and landing from a layup from hitting a ball in volleyball. Theoretically then, if somebody was landing and their hip was a little bit internally rotated and there was that knee caving in, it wouldn't be necessarily injuring the ligaments as knee valgus would, right?
Think of it this way. Here's the nuance. The hip internally rotating, if that was just a default movement pattern and you came down and you landed on one leg, that is where you probably blow your knee out. If that was the movement strategy you went to, because even though the movement's coming from the hip, you're still, if you're on one leg, it doesn't work the same.
Yeah, also because like the whole weight is just loading on that single leg, the end you're
Right.
landing
And
also with gravity.
the problem is the strategy, this internal rotation kind of torquing strategy works when you're on two legs to propel you
Good to know.
upward, and it works on one leg to propel you sideways.
But
So if
not
you're coming
landing.
down from a jump, landing on one leg, and that's the strategy that your leg takes on, either consciously or subconsciously,
Yeah.
you're either going sideways or the knee is just going to go all the way and there's going to be nothing supporting it. And that's
Yeah.
not a good time. So there is definitely a place for that, training the knee out. If there's an uncontrollable kind of caving in of the foot and the knee that isn't just a loading strategy, it's actually just a compensation that you can't control. That's where you're going to see problems coming down from jumps and things like that. So I think one thing that gets maybe under focused on with this is actually the foot, because if you have an arch of the foot that is very soft and weak, that will just cave in any pressure, that's often the thing that shoots the knee inward. So it's you have to think with the knee that it's the foot below it and the hip above it that are like the steering wheels for it. The knee is a
And it just goes
dumb,
wherever.
yeah, the knee is a dumb joint that moves one direction, and it's just listening to the foot and the hip, and that's all it's doing. So a lot of problems with the knee focus should be above and below it.
Well, good to know. You know, in the training world, there are a few ways to measure workout intensity without doing any math. One of them is also the RPE scale, which is the rate of perceived exertion scale. To begin, what is this scale, Jacob?
As the name suggests, rate of perceived exertion, it is just how hard did you feel like the session was. So I personally use a 1 to 10, just kind of keeping it simple. Some people use a 6 to 20, and I try to keep it to like lower numbers just as an easier way to answer. And if you wanted a little more like higher definition answers, you could go with the 0.5s, like allow a 7.5, and then you're getting a little more granular with the answers. But I know the 6 to 20 is often used as well.
So we actually learned about the 6 to 20 in one of my classes. Shout out Dr. Howarth. So it's really helpful if you A, don't have a watch that is able to actually keep your heart rate count going. And also if you can't really track your intensity that well, because you know, when you're working out, how do you actually know that you're working the system as hard as you potentially should? So how it works is, first of all, it's based off your age, because your age is directly correlated to your heart rate max. So for most people, it's about 220 minus your age. So for anybody who's, you know, in their 20s, that means that their heart rate max should be anywhere between like 190 to 200 heart beats per minute. So how the scale works is, if you're working out and you know you're starting a warm up, you can ask yourself, okay, how do I feel? How's the intensity? We start at six, so six should be the easiest. All you're gonna do is do 6 times 10. So you can assume now that your heart rate is just in the 60 range. It's not very specific, it's kind of arbitrary. And then as you keep going into your workout, for example, if you're into the aerobic stage now, you're running on the treadmill, you're gonna ask yourself again, okay, out of 6 from 20, what do I feel? If you feel as if you're working hard, that's usually in the 16 to 18 range. All you're gonna do is multiply 16 times 10, and now you know that you're in the 160. And it's really helpful too, because if you do feel like you're working too hard, most of the time it's because you are. And with this quick math, you can actually figure out if you're reaching your heart rate max, which for us would be around the 200s.
And it's easy math. I love it.
Yeah, it's easy math. It's literally just, as long as you kind of you can Google it, literally the 6 to 20 RPE scale, and it'll show you that 6 to 8 ranges to the light, 10 to 12 is a little bit more, all the way up to 18 to 20 being extremely, extremely hard. So Jacob, you mentioned that you use the 1 to 10 scale. What are the benefits of using an RPE scale for athletes?
Yeah, I'll give a little background on workload to start with, because
Yeah.
in the sports science world, you have the external measures of load and the internal measures of load. And gold standards have both, but the external is essentially the performance, the output, the weight that you lifted, the reps you did, how far you ran, how fast you went, things like the things that are kind of, if you and someone else did the same thing, the same number would be produced. The
Right.
internal measures of workload are where you and someone else who did the same external, say you both ran a kilometer, the external workload is exactly the same, but the internal workload, which could be measured through something like heart rate or RPE, could be drastically different. So you and a teammate both do a kilometer run at the exact same pace, your shoulder to shoulder the whole time. One of you will have a higher heart rate than the other, just based off
Exactly.
variations in fitness and various different things. And that's where it's good to have measures of both, because one side of the story only tells part of the picture. So,
Yeah.
what I like to do is, because usually it's the external numbers that require some technology. Obviously, in the gym, you can track weights and reps and things like that. It's easy. But if you are in practice or doing a skill session or a run or something like that, it gets a little more complicated, or at least requires some technology. So what I like to do, and I actually have a product available on the website that's the load management system, that this is as simple as it is. You track the RPE on a 1 to 10 scale, and then you plug in how long the session lasted. The great thing about this is you can use the same calculation for practice, for a game, for a skill session, for a run, for a strength training session. You can apply the same to any type of activity, and then you are racking up kind of like total workload from all sources. So what happens is you say, I did 60 minutes at an RPE of 5. So then you get this 300 units of arbitrary load. And then that, in the at least in the spreadsheet that I offer, it tracks that over time, gives you the graphs and everything for like, is it trending up, down, whatever. But then I think the upside of the sheet, the coolest part of it, is it will automatically track how fast the workload is either going up or down, which has some really important insights. Because if it goes up too fast, if you do 50% more this week than you did last week, that's a recipe for increasing injury risk, because
Exactly.
you are not trained to handle those
That stress on your
workloads.
system.
Exactly. And on the flip side of that, this is when people hear load management. I know this was a thing in the NBA years ago when it first started getting talked about, where everyone thought it was just about holding players back. And there's this whole other part of it, which is pushing players forward, where if your workload starts to go down, that means if it's down long enough, it means your fitness is going down, which also has implications with injury risk. Because if you're
Exactly.
less fit, that's a risk all on itself.
Yeah, there's
So,
two sides.
exactly. So, the sheet actually automatically will give you basically written recommendations, like workload's a little bit low, increase it over the next week or so. And there's a bunch of different options in there. But if you don't have the sheet and you're just looking at it yourself, you can just track this two numbers, the 1 to 10, how hard it was, the duration. If you do multiple sessions in a day, you can add them together. So your 300 units of load and then your 200 units of load from your strength session or whatever the case is. And if you track that over the days and over the week, and then you can compare this week to last week and so on, then all you're basically looking for is that you're not making jumps of more than 20 to 30% at a time. And that's going to make sure you can see progress and increase fitness Without completely overworking yourself and doing way too much.
And how can it be used to your advantage regarding heart rate measures specifically?
Yeah, I think with when it comes to kind of the load management stuff, heart rate's going to be the gold standard for that internal side of the
Right.
tracking. But that's something that, I mean, I know like Apple Watches are becoming more popular and
Yeah.
a lot of people do have some sort of tracker on them. And if you have that, by all means, use it. I think that's great. But in the event it's not available or in a game when you can't wear your watch, then
Exactly.
using the RPE can just be a replacement where it's some measure of how hard you felt it was, which will, like you were saying, will track relatively closely with what your heart rate is. And then there's your load management system right there.
There we go. All right, guys, that will bring us to the end of today's episode. Thank you, Jacob, and thank you guys for listening. We'll see you next time.
Thank you. See you then.
See you guys.